Blog Talk Radio.
Aloha. Hey, everybody. This is Janine, and you're listening to Lunch with Loudon, a part of Coffee Party Internet Radio and our Be the Media project. If you'd like to be a part of Be the Media, go to www.coffeepartyusa.com. Don't forget to sign the civility pledge while you're there, and then find where you can click into being a volunteer. If you're specifically interested in Coffee Party Internet Radio, say so. If you want another door in just for conversation about what that might be, you can go to Lunch with Loudon on Facebook and send us a message and say, hey, tell me more about Be the Media. So it's a gray day here in the foothills of the Oregon Coast Range, and I'm a little bit relieved because I'm totally surrounded by forest fires, and if I go outside, I smell the smoke. My co-pilot, Debbie Lynn Molyneux, is in Portlandia. Debbie Lynn, is the smoke index high there today, too?
You know, it's cloudy today, but I haven't smelled smoke. So it still smells like forest up here, which is what we normally smell like in Portland. And for that, I'm grateful.
Excellent, excellent. Yeah, my brother's just been deployed again to wildfire, I think this time near the Dalles. Oh, my gosh.
There is one just east of us. And, you know, last week when I stopped and saw you in Corvallis and drove south, I drove for 3 hours, 150 miles with smoke. So, yeah. Our hearts go out to everybody who's suffering with forest fires right now.
It's 55 fires in the 10 western states. So there's our weather report, you guys. It's very real to us what's going on. Just like I'm sure the flooding on the East Coast is very real if you're there. And you can't walk outside without smelling it, so it's amazing. Today, we have a very, on the one hand, delicate subject to discuss, and on another hand, it's like so exciting. And what's exciting about it to me and to Debbie Lynn is that the conversation about civility, the contribution civility makes to you and me, not only in our daily life, but in the world, is really kind of brought to a head for me right now because this weekend or in a day or two is the celebration of the 50th anniversary of the I Have a Dream speech. And civility was a huge tool in Dr. King's arsenal, not unlike Gandhi and his notion of passive nonviolent resistance. But the whole notion that civil discourse can move mountains, and even if those mountains appear hostile and dangerous and threatening, and there is a basic fundamental human psychology behind this notion. And I want to take just a minute to read from our post today on Join the Coffee Party Movement Facebook page, so that we can sort of set the tone for what we want to talk about here, because this is as much to inform as it is to ask you, do you see this in your own life? Do you encounter these things in your own life? How do you deal with the things we're about to talk about? So real quickly, this is a short read. Human beings can become addicted to their opinions, and that addiction can prevent meaningful communication. There are at least two different approaches to this topic. There's the science of what is happening in our brain that reinforces this behavior, and there are the broader social implications to our culture and the world. If everyone wants to be right, is it any wonder we evolve to power struggles at every level, from the office politics to religious conflict to worldviews that impact our survivability on the planet? According to brain researcher Judith Glasser, in situations of high stress, fear, or distrust, the hormone and neurotransmitter cortisol floods the brain. Executive functions that help us with advanced thought processes like strategy, trust building, and compassion shut down. It's just biologically so. And the amygdala, or instinctive brain, some people call it the lizard brain, takes over. We go into fight, flight, freeze, or appease mode. It is from this place where our heart hardens towards others and we become unaware of how closed-minded we have become. Think righteous indignation. Conversely, Glasser continues, when you argue and win, your brain floods with different hormones, adrenaline and dopamine, which make you feel good, dominant, even invincible. It's a feeling any of us would want to replicate. So the next time we're in a tense situation, we fight again. We get addicted to being right. Realizing that we can change our automatic human perception of others, drop our defenses, and actually hear what other people have to say is not always easy. It is the foundation of civility. It is the foundation of change. Are you in? Debbie Lynn, when we were talking about this topic, I think you had a lot to say, and so maybe you should be our opening salvo today.
Yeah, last week I was traveling, as most of you know who were listening last week, but I got on a conference call while sitting in a hotel room with some folks who were around the country, and it was with another organization that I do work with. And one of the women that was on the call just became angry, and it was like we could not understand what the anger was based on or about, and so it became clear very quickly that our base assumptions about our working relationship were very different, very, very different. And the other woman on the call with us went into appease mode. So she just started agreeing with everything that the angry woman was saying. And my physical body, my response was, oh, my God, I'm under attack. And so I became very aware of, like, just my whole body being tense and wanting to, you know, not just freeze but also flee. I wanted to get the hell off the call as fast as possible, which was why my counterpart was in appease mode. And so I had all of this input going on all simultaneously, like listening, watching the appease mode, feeling my own physical body reacting in freeze, in flight mode. And all of a sudden, you know, I kind of clicked in of like, okay, there's something else going on here. And I started listening really deeply to what the angry woman was saying. And the more deeply I listened to her, the more I understood that she felt her reputation was at risk because of a misunderstanding between her and myself. And the minute that clicked in for me, I made an apology to her for that misunderstanding because she had made an offer to me that I had accepted, but she hadn't meant to make the offer as deeply as I accepted it. And so the minute that interaction between her and I happened, she accepted my apology, she stopped being angry, and the call, like, went on. And it was amazing to me how by not reacting to her or to the whole fight or flight physical response I was having or going into appease mode, because that was not working either, just that simple act of deeply listening and apologizing shifted the energy of the conversation. And since that time, moving forward on this other project, it's been a dream to work on. It's been really, really nice.
Well, and isn't it amazing that there you are on the phone? You're not, I mean, this is wonderful that you start with a non-political example, but there you are on the phone. There's no way she can throw her coffee cup at you. There's no way she can hurt you physically. And yet, right. You know, what I learned back in the day when I was in school, my degree is in human health. But, you know, if you took a blood test at that moment in time, you would have the same blood chemistry as someone who's being chased by a tiger. I mean, mm-hmm. threat is threat is threat, and it comes way down from the brainstem, and it totally blocks what we call our humanity. And maybe someone else is a better physiologist than I, but basically we have three brains. We've got the brainstem or your lizard brain. You've got your mammal brain, and then you have your human brain, that forebrain. I was talking to my niece before the show. she's visiting. She's a psychology major at University of Santa Clara. And I said, riddle me this. In the domain of neuropsychology, what is the best defense to finding yourself in this primal condition? And she said, get thee to thy forebrain. You know, do whatever it takes to get out of that biological lock that is human. I mean, we are all these brains. We are human as a part of our humanity. Mm-hmm. And then find a way back to thought, reasoning, deduction, logic, facts, all those things that hang out up there in the above your brow. And it's also what also resides there is the ability. One of the things that makes us human is the ability to create a future that, from the past, use information of any kind and project a future. And you know, so it's like our job to predict, to commit to and go for something more than what's happening right now.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Right. And so I think in terms of politics, just sort of bringing it home to coffee party, civility, and the elements of change, if we want to see change in the world. I think that this link is I don't want to say simple, easy. I mean, it's obvious when you see it happen. I've shared with people before that until my sister connected me with Coffee Party, I was like a prowler out there, duking it out with people who didn't agree with me and using all my tools of rhetoric, logic, whatever I thought, and being brilliant at it, of course. And when it occurred to me that all those good people, bad people, who knows, those people were as positional as I was, were as incapable of hearing me as I was of hearing them. I realized, well, there's a waste of keystrokes, or there's a waste of, you know, airtime, or there's a waste of, it's just plain a waste. And as a matter of fact, I think it reinforces, Debbie Lynn, what we just read about in terms of, you know, the juice. You know, the juice mm-hmm. that our brain produces when it's in that situation. And I don't believe that everybody gets addicted to being right. So if you're listening out there and you think I'm accusing, I'm not. But I'm saying it happens. And even if you're not addicted, you're going to experience these opportunities for outrage.
Well, even I, you know, I mean, I've been practicing, you know, and working on this not having to be right stuff for 30 years because I, you know, just because of my growing up years, I was in a household with, you know, an alcoholic, abusive stepfather who had to be right all the time. So to not be right in my family was death. You know, it was equivalent to death. And so unlearning that, it has been 30 years in the making, and I still fall into it occasionally. We all do. But being aware of it, I think, is the key, you know, to like moving forward and actually having a transformative experience for the world. Because if everybody is in that place of having to be right all the time, well, we can see what's happening in our country and in the world, and it's not something that I like. I want something else.
Right. Right. It's true. So I'm assuming that all those people I see in chat and all these people I see on the phone board might have something to contribute to this conversation. I'm especially interested in your experience with this phenomena, how you manage it yourself, how you deal with it when it sort of gets dumped in your lap. Our phone number for calling in live is 646-929-2495. Debbie Lynn is our ever-faithful chat observer, and I'm trying to watch it today, too. So certainly it's not a conversation without you, although I know Debbie Lynn and I can talk about this the entire hour because we both have experiences in bumping up against attitude or misinformation. I mean, one of the things that struck me when we did our post today and joined the Coffee Party movement on Facebook, a bunch of the responses, at first they're kind of funny, you know, talking about, what, me, who? You know, and And my favorite in the beginning was Chris York, who said, nuh-uh. Because, you know, it is kind of where children go. But there's some wonderful comments. Here's one. Fortunately, there's also the ability to learn, ponder, and change your mind. So there is a chance, no matter how slight, to say to yourself, I am wrong. The crowd mentality, card-carrying banality has to go. Think with your heart, mind, soul, and not toe the party line. So I will be dealing with it, wrong, right, left, however. And I thought that was a very thoughtful response. Because the truth is, there's just like a stopped clock, right, twice a day. Or as my brother says, even the blind chicken gets some corn. It's also true that as much as I hate to think it, I am not always right. And other people can actually be a contribution to me. They can add to my fact base. They can add to my the realm of possibility in my thinking. They can actually say things to me that shake up the things that are kind of locked in to my way of being. And it is such a gift when it happens. I had this like white light experience almost once when my friend, who is a photojournalist, and she had been in one of the war-torn countries in Africa for a while, doing a photo documentary piece on an orphanage. And it turned out while she was there, past President George Herbert Walker Bush was going to tour that country and was going to visit the very orphanage that she was documenting. And so when the day came, there's this big tape line, and all the press and all the media are back behind the line, and the president and his security come waltzing in, as one would expect. But because my friend had been there for a long time, she was one of them, she was inside the line. She was with the children and captured the most beautiful, authentic, genuinely loving photo of that President Bush I've ever seen, because behind him were his security people, and he walked into this crowd of children and crouched down and put out his arms, and it was the face of a loving grandfather that was embracing all these little orphans. And I thought to myself, it was really easier when I didn't think of him as human. But clearly this image captures his humanity. And I had to consider the possibility that while I may have a lot of ideological differences with this man, I could not deny his humanity and his authenticity as a person. Whether I agreed with him or not, different issue. He was not, what's the word I want to use? He was not an inanimate object. He was not a robot. He actually had to come into my domain as one of me. He had to become not the other.
I would offer he was not inherently evil, which was one of the links that we had out there, which oftentimes we treat the other, whoever the other is for us, as being inherently evil.
Right. All or nothing. In my camp, in my tribe, in my whatever, or not. You know, and that's certainly one of the ways that crimes against humanity occur. As long as you can make those others less than you, not human, not meaningful, not important, or go even farther down the spectrum to evil, then it doesn't matter what happens to them. And then in my sense, humanity is lost, and it's once again that lizard brain running the show. So how do we deal with this, Debbie Lynn? How do we deal with this day to day, event to event? How do we become the guardians of civility, of humanity, in our conversations and our dealings with other people?
Well, I would propose that one of them is through compassion. And I mean, you've pointed to it already, and that is like finding a point of humanity in the other person. You know, for me, in the example that I gave, and I have others I could give, but I always try and listen so deeply that I find like, what is the source of the number one of, you know, whatever the conflict is. And if not that, I look for, like, what do I have in common with this person that, you know, where I can find their humanity. And, you know, right now it's so easy to be demonizing, you know, some of the politicos out there who are, you know, looking to, you know, one of my hot button issues is, you know, women's choice. You know, it's so easy for me to demonize who were, like, passing anti-abortion laws. But yet, they're, in their essence, I believe they're truly frightened because the world is changing beyond their control. And from that point of recognizing their fear and their attempt to maintain control, I can find some compassion in their fear. That doesn't mean,
sure,
I'm going to agree with them or do anything to, or that I'm going to stop opposing them or fighting, but I can at least not demonize them to the point where I want to wipe them off the face of the earth. Because,
well,
that's
that's more about me. That kind of takes us to another comment that was at Join the Coffee Party Movement Facebook page today. One of the responses, well, several of them were actually, well, what do you do if they are wrong? What do you do if you are right? And you know, you sort of segued into that, Debbie Lynn, when you said, well, it doesn't mean I'm not going to continue to support my perspective or counter their mm-hmm. point of view. But I would assert that it alters how you do that. And if the ultimate objective is meaningful conversation, that's at least enhanced. You know, the possibility that you're actually going to hear something you haven't heard, or that they're going to hear something they haven't heard before. I mean, this is, you know, go back to the snowy video, Annabelle Park standing on the street saying, nothing's going to change for the better until we can talk to one another. And sometimes talking to one another is not easy. But
right.
I guess no one ever said it was easy. They just said it was meaningful and important. You know, said it was a requirement for resolution, as opposed to saying it would be easy or it will come mm-hmm. naturally. Or because all the way back to, if you really loved me, you'd know what I wanted for Christmas, you know. I mean, it just, we can become very
oh yeah, that part of reading each other's minds, that part doesn't, you know, that one always cracks me up. You should just know, if you love me you would know. I'm like, yeah, that, you know, I missed that installation, you know, when I was born. I'm sorry. Psychic powers didn't come with me.
Or that terrible movie from the 70s, 60s or 70s, Love Story. Love means you never have to say you're sorry. I almost walked out of the movie.
Oh, my, like, God, that makes me want to throw up.
I know, because it's really more like, if you really love something, somebody, anything, you're actually willing to say, oh, my God, I blew it.
Yeah.
No, I'm so sorry. But no. Holly McGraw and whoever the pretty boy was that was with her, it was all airy-fairy. And, you know, and life's a little more dicey than that. And so, again, for our listeners, I see you out there. Our number is 646-929-2495. We're getting some great comments in chat, and maybe Debbie Lynn, you can share those with me.
Yeah, I want to give a shout out here to Bob, who is Biz Tutor Magic in the chat room. Sorry for adding you there, Bob Woodburn, because he's commenting here on how he's totally for equal rights and right on that issue. As a heterosexual man, he doesn't understand why people think that equal protection under the law doesn't apply to everyone. And he's also outing himself that as an avocational constitutional scholar, he sees other people's points of view, but he still knows, or believes, he doesn't say no, but he believes his interpretation is correct. And so we're having some fun talking about that. Now, Mike, also in chat earlier, was asking a question about, and I needed some clarification. He was asking if we were talking more about, I'm looking for it in chat, something about normalcy bias. Is this relative to normalcy bias? And I went and looked that up on Wikipedia. And this has something to do with the way the brain processes new data, that it takes us a longer time to process new information and stress slowing down that process. And if we don't find an acceptable response to the situation, we actually fixate on a single or even default solution, which may or may not be correct. And this is part of So I would say that is a possible cause. I have encountered people where when given facts that don't fit into their worldview, discard them entirely, because to accept those facts would mean that their worldview is inaccurate, and it would totally like pull the rug out from under their life. And so I would say that, you know, that's why they discard the facts, because they would have to redo their whole life and they would feel lost.
Well, sure. I mean, it's the dualisms, dichotomies, whatever you want to call them, are always a challenge when you're trying to think through something. For example, if you're right, I must be wrong. And then it becomes, well, if you're right, does that make you right globally? Like about everything.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make me wrong globally about everything? And that we aren't, my education included ways of looking at that we're not just yes, no, black, white, you're right or I'm right, and there's no in between. I think people also, what I experience in a Facebook world, a social media world, not just Facebook, is that there's this tendency to not know what a non-fatal error is, or not know what a non-fatal disagreement is. You know what I'm saying? I mean, obviously, I'm not going to have a conversation about if I'm in my house and some stranger comes and attacks my child, I'm not going to worry about anybody's civil rights. I'm going to take care of the situation the best I can in that moment in my house with my child.
Of course.
And so there are times where we have a luxury of discussing that situation from distance, remotely, in the rearview mirror, so to speak, or in a hypothetical possibility. And those are very, very different. What I see too often in social media is that everything is that guy hurting my child in my house. It's all life or death. It's all black and white. It's as opposed to having it be a conversation for possibility. What is out there? How do you feel? Why do you think that applies to me and not just, you know, your preference is not my edict.
Right.
As an example.
Right. And just to give you a heads up, Janine, we do have a caller online. It's somebody we know and love.
Oh, you're right. I just came back from Facebook looking at that answer. And I'm going to open up the mic for 503. Welcome to the show, Mr. Aronson.
Hello, Ms. Loudon, Ms. Malino. How are you?
Excellent.
Good.
Yeah, this is a 4-hour show, if you wanted to do this topic right, because in setting it up, you already pointed out there's two different ways to kind of attack this, and probably more than two, but you even talked about two. So one is we look at why. What is it within ourselves, biologically, psychologically, that make us who we are and react the way we do to certain things, right? You talked about the primordial brain, right, versus,
yes,
you know, the fight or flight kind of versus the, you know, and the base emotions versus, you know, how do I just turn that stuff off and only just, like, you know, become an intelligent human being and apply intellect, pure intellect. So that's a battle for most people, and it's gotten worse because it's become the social norm, unfortunately, you know, promoted by, of course, the 1% media, that fighting is now okay. That's the way we now resolve conflict, by we just fight. We yell, we scream. You turn on any news program and they'll have their panel of six, or their two people on either sides of an issue. And you watch those people interact, and they're talking over each other and yelling, and you're a liar, oh, you're obfuscating the facts, blah, blah. I mean, it's just, unfortunately, it's become the norm. That's what we're fighting against. And that's probably the biggest, you know, steepest part of the hill that we're trying to get up.
Well,
yeah. Like, Dan, whatever happened to manners? Whatever happened to manners, for continent's sake? Like, what? Go ahead, Debbie Lynn.
Well, I just wanted to say, you know, this Dan, you're doing a setup for me that we hadn't even talked about, but one of the shows I'm trying to line up for a couple weeks from now is to get Joan Blaise back on here with Living Room Conversations and actually start, you know, set up a Living Room Conversation specifically for coffee parties and find out what do we in coffee party want to talk about that we could have people all across the country doing at the same time. And so I just threw this out in the chat room to ask people, like, would this, how do we return to stability in our country? Would that be a good topic for a coffee party living room conversation?
Oh, exactly. And Dan, you know, you also pointed to the whole, you know, when you point to biology, it adds a whole new distinction to the term juicy. Like, that's really juicy. And now I imagine my brain just swimming in these chemicals of fight or flight, you know, freeze or appease. So, and you were saying?
Well, no, I was just saying, so that's one. Now, the second thing is how do you functionally engage and what do you put into practice once you are engaged, right? So, you know, to me, I'm a big Sun Tzu guy, right? So Sun Tzu says, if I know myself, that's half the battle. If I know my enemy, right, or we don't want to necessarily use the word enemy, obviously, but the other person, then, and if I know both of those things, then I'm good, right? And it says I need not fear the outcome of 1,000 battles. But here's the thing, I don't know how many people pass that first test. I don't know how many people are really in touch with their own feelings and understand their own motivations and can recognize the warning signs of an escalation of emotion and the hot buttons that people try to push to get you there enough to be able to do what you said to do, right? Push yourself into the front of the brain, right?
Mm-hmm.
I've got to be
right.
able to overcome those. And I think people sometimes don't really have a good inventory of their own hot buttons. And if you don't recognize it, then how do you stop it?
Oh, I think that's precisely the problem. I think you can mistake living in this biochemical ping pong match for living fully. And
mm-hmm.
and I do think it takes exposure to, in your case, it's martial arts and other things. I've spent a lifetime sort of looking at what it is to be human. And it's for myself. I'm just going to answer this question because you asked it, and then I hope other people will join us, 646-929-2495, and talk about what they do. But for myself, I've created over time and continue to create every day things I call red flags. And the red flags are indicators to me, reminders that the last time you felt this way, this didn't go well. Or this was non-productive. It's probably a better way to say it. Because I guess you could misinterpret this didn't go well for I lost that one. And it's not so much for me about winning or losing today. It's not about winning or losing. It's more about did we get to the heart of the matter? Did we solve the problem at hand? Or did we go down some rabbit trail that didn't resolve the thing that needed resolving at the time? And so when I see these red flags come up, Debbie Lynn just spoke to some of them, you know, when you could be on the phone and feel like you need to grab a spear and throw it at something, you know, then that's obviously a flag. But there are others. And for me, if I find myself on the verge of speaking denigration, you know, to someone, when I'm going to go for the hurt and not for the point, I just shut up. You know, it's so far all I can do. If I can shut up, if I can be quiet, and if I can try to get back to that thinking place, then I can respond. Otherwise, I would really rather look an idiot than open my mouth and prove myself one.
And it's important to remember, I think, Janine, that part of the way that we came to the using the red flag, why isn't it the green flag or the blue flag, because red is stop, and red, but red is also the color of the cape that they wave in front of the bull, right, to get him charging.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
You don't want me charging. I'm nasty, and I don't like it. I won't do it.
Right.
I just refuse.
But and
well,
you're also so laser beam focused that that you miss all of the other things that are going on, because it's, and I know this is something I fight on a regular basis, and it has been since I've been a kid, is that you're in the middle of a conversation and someone's making a somewhat elaborate point, and you start formulating the answer to that particular thing, what you're listening to this very second.
Yes.
And now everything after that person says is not, it's not a play. It's like, I just can't wait to respond now. And that's one of the things I fight on a regular basis.
Right, you're playing tennis.
Absolutely. Yeah, because that prohibits what you're addressing right there, Dan, is you shut off your deep listening because you're ready to respond before they're done talking.
Exactly.
And
now, of course,
let me just finish here real quick.
One of the tools
that I use, because oftentimes when we end up in that end up in this place where we're acting out of the amygdala, the lizard brain, or even out of the emotional, the limbic system place, is that we're actually in the drama triangle, the Cartman drama triangle, where there's a victim, a rescuer, and a persecutor. That's something that is so prevalent in our culture. And there's an alternative to that called the creator, or the empowerment dynamic, excuse me, where we can switch from the drama triangle into this creator orientation. And there are simple questions to ask yourself to help switch into the front of your brain, which is one of the tools that I use. And this is outlined, if anybody wants to know it, at powerkid.com. I'll put that in chat in just a minute. But the question to ask yourself, if you're in that place where you're trying to make the point and trying to drive to be right, is to ask, what is your intention? Do you need to say this too? It's like, what is my intention here? Is it to go for their jugular to be right? Or am I really trying to address the point to add to the situation to make it better? And asking question about intention is crucial to getting out of the I'm addicted to being right place.
I think that's a nice tactic, Debbie Lynn, you know, to sort of question your own intentions. Like, what is it I'm trying to get out of this at this moment? Not generally, but in this moment. I do almost exactly the same thing when I feel attacked, but I just stop and say, what is it you want me to know from what you're telling me? You know, so if I can take responsibility for not understanding what they're saying to me, or for not, like, tell me what it is you want me to know. Then I can tell I'm getting all the slings and arrows of a position.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes it just stops us both. You know, so I don't mean it like a tactic, like, oh, here's tool number 17 and you just do this. I sincerely want to know, or I wouldn't ask that question. But I often find myself in a position where I sincerely want to know, and it's not possible from the level of vitriol that is bubbling up, you know, in that from the lizard brain, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and that applies perfectly to, you know, part three, which is knowing the other person. And one of the things I see that breaks down conversation very much, or dooms it, I would almost say from the get-go, is this. And I really dislike it when people do it to me. It's when people start with an argument that assumes certain things about me, right?
Yes.
You're a Republican, therefore this is how I'm going to argue. Well, wait a second, I'm not a Republican, I'm an independent guy. Why are you doing that? And so what I think, and this is something that comes a little bit natural to me only because I've been a lifelong sales guy. And the first thing you do when you get into your conversation with the potential customer is to ask them a lot of questions to unearth where their motivations are, what are they really trying to accomplish. You don't just launch into your pitch. And I think so many people just launch into a pitch without stopping to understand the other person and what they're trying to accomplish and what are their motivations and what are their experiences that have molded their minds into this particular place where they're at. And if you don't understand that, if you don't take the time to understand the other person, you're pretty that conversation is pretty much doomed.
I agree with that. I think assumptions, you know, there's the old saying about what assume means. But I do think assumptions that you kind of like wallpaper over the actual person that you're talking to are bad from both points of view. It means the person speaking to you, Dan, really isn't speaking to you. And so they're actually not having a conversation with you. They're having a conversation with the wallpaper. And then you're behind the wallpaper. So what comes through is, you know, very ineffective if what you want is a mutual understanding or communication with one another. And so assumptions are deadly. They're deadly in business. They're deadly in parenting. I mean, this isn't just a political issue. When you allow your assumptions to drive your interactions with the world, the world becomes very small because you and I can only have so many assumptions, right? And so this itty-bitty world gets battered by anything that challenges those assumptions, and it's really an unhappy place to live. You know, I have experience with this with a family member who just cannot, you know, 10 things in the world are true and everything else is an attack. And that's frightening. It's not a, you know, and then the reverse of that, of course, is when you use vitriol or that intensity as a method of domination or control. You know, because who wants to argue with somebody who's screaming at them or saying terrible things to them? Or, you know, and the answer is other people like them.
Well, right.
And I walk away from those. It's like it's like getting, you know, a dog fight with a skunk, you know. It's like, what? I can't go there.
So I think functionally there are certain cues, verbal cues, and maybe this is a whole other project, like a John Cash and Civics Minutes moment. Is to little vignettes to point out in conversations, you know, the red flags, right? So, like, you know,
yeah.
One of the things you just touched on is that whole idea of assumptions, right? And so, from a political standpoint, if you say, well, if you hear generalizations, the GOP thinks this, Democrats think this, liberals are like this, and all of a sudden you're painting with these huge strokes, right? Big wide brush strokes, or like you said, it's wallpapering. But you know, that's a red flag, right? It's like, don't lump me in with all those people, and don't make generalizations about other people. It doesn't make sense. It's me. Hi, I'm Dan. You're Janine. Let's talk about Dan and Janine. Let's not talk about the attributes of groups that even if they self-identify.
Right. Because otherwise, we can't share our story. You know, here's how I feel. This is why I feel it. I mean, that's very fundamental, right? But yesterday, I posted in Join the Coffee Party Movement Facebook page an image of Dr. King, Martin Luther King, and it said, "Let no man pull you low enough to hate him." And again, my whole reason for doing this topic today is inspired a great deal by the fact that this the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington is happening now. And I have genuine remorse that I can't be there. There are just situations in my life right now that make that not possible. And so my experience right now is to try to bring that event to me since I can't go to it. And so I'm really deep in the inquiry of the message, Dr. King's message, and how it was so strong for so long and then how it has faded over the last while. And I think, you know, there are many here listening today or streaming in the future who will remember that march and who will remember that speech, the I Have a Dream speech. I had the joy at the Enough is Enough citizen intervention almost 2 years ago in Washington, D.C. with Coffee Party, of working with a volunteer who had marched with Dr. King on that day. And it was like, oh, there is such sometimes when I find myself in that crazy making space, this is where I go. I go to remembering who it is in the world I admire and why I admired them and what they were able to accomplish or the change they made, the difference they made in the world. And then I can come back to, I need to hear what you're saying. Or you and I, it's pointless to disagree even if I can't hear what you're saying. Now, does that mean that ultimately somebody's not right or somebody's not wrong? I mean, sure, there are cases where, you know, there's just plain wrongdoing going on. There's law breaking. Somebody described the coffee party to me one time as this big, you know, need to kumbaya or something. And Dan and Debbie Lynn, I think you both agree with me that this is not about kumbaya. This is about, if you're going to fight, at least fight about what you really disagree about and not other things. Go ahead.
And having been in this work now for 6 or 7 years, you know, people think that we just need to do something. And it's like, yes, the first thing we need to do is build a relationship with each other. And I don't know about you, but my best relationships were not built in 3 months. They took hella time to create because we have to live together and talk to each other, and it takes years sometimes for those relationships to develop. And then if you start thinking about how do we build relationships with people who are different than us, who might rub us the wrong way, who, you know, feel like a burr under the saddle sometimes, that's going to take a little bit longer even because we have to work through all that discomfort. But building that relationship is hard work. And then once we have that together, then we can start doing a lot of these things that we're talking about in the chat room, which is, you know, starting to address the opinion versus fact issues or finding facts that we can agree on. You know, I have another friend right now who's working on trying to find scientists on the fracking issue who will come together and give both the pro and anti-fracking communities facts they can agree on because they have different opposing facts right now. And the scientists are not in agreement. And so how can any of us who are not scientists agree when nobody has the same facts? And these are not opinions even. We're not even having an opinion conversation. These are scientists who have different opposing facts.
Well, the scientific community will disagree with that statement. See, that's okay. You know,
right.
There are...
Well, I'm talking with somebody from the... Yeah, so that's exactly right because they're, you know, but the people who have a different belief have different scientists that they talk to.
That's right.
But we also have to recognize in that scientists themselves are doing, in many cases, are doing a lot of extrapolating and interpolating and in some cases a lot of guesswork and assumptions, making a lot of assumptions that then they will try to, they use that to formulate the framework for then they put what data they do have, the real facts they do have, into that and say, okay, here's what I come out with. And it's the different modeling that causes the different results. It's not that they're using the different actual hard facts, but it's how they're modeling that out. And on the political spectrum, it's the same thing when you hear, like in the debates, I remember in the Bush-Kerry debates, when George Bush came out with that, hey, you know, that's fuzzy math, you know, but it's because people are trying to say, if we do this and change this tax code, piece of the tax code, then 20 years down the road, we'll have X amount of extra revenue or we'll have been able to reduce the debt. Well, they're guessing because there's a million factors that could change between now and whenever they're making that prediction that would just throw the whole thing out the window. And so I think that's yet another important thing to talk about is to realize when we have these conversations, are we talking about things that are actual facts or are we talking about things where we're making assumptions and it's based on some kind of modeling? And so we have to at least agree at the beginning that we might not agree and that, hey, maybe we should get together at a month from now and see if there's new data in and let's talk about it again.
Right.
Hey, let me come back to that in just a second. I know, I'm just going to bring, we have another caller I'm going to bring into our conversation. Everybody's mics are still live. Area code 661, is this Egberto?
Yes, this is Egberto. First of all, I wanted to commend Debbie-Lynn because that's what got me to push that one. When she said that you cannot expect to build a relationship in a month, in 2 months, in 3 months, but it takes a lot more than that. And during the time that you're going to be building that relationship, you can't pick up your marbles and run, which is I think we see around, and that is, if we have a disagreement, as opposed to cooling off, or as opposed to sometimes saying, well, at this point, since we simply won't disagree, we need to agree to disagree on this one and move on other areas. A lot of times we don't do that. We just pick up and run. I want to address something that Dan said, though, because it kind of rubbed me on the other side. There's a scientific method, and when there is a scientific method, while it is true that a lot of this occurs with modeling, where things can actually change, modeling is all that you've got, and you have to come to agreements on how policies are going to actually get effected. So they get effected based on modeling, and as long as you have honest modeling, not modeling by corporations, or what we fight against with regards to the corporate influence in modeling, we cannot allow folks to destroy the scientific process because it doesn't give them the type of results that they want. Modeling is how we set policies, and it's the only way that we set policies, because nobody really knows the future, but we have to do it that way. That's what I want to say. Thank you.
Well, and I think there's something to be said for this, Egberto, because you know what we, the consensus of information or the data available, I mean, always changes. What I get concerned about with myself, and therefore, you know, sort of wonder for others, is do I remember why I believe this? You know what I'm saying? There is some experience, there is some information, there is some transaction, there is some reason I believe this. And when that circumstance changes, or when my worldview changes to mitigate that reason, am I capable of changing my mind about something?
And that is the magic. That is the magic. The magic is we abide by the model that we abide by the honest model that we have, but we are intellectually honest enough to know that if there are parameters that have changed in that model, that we are willing to be frank about it. Hey, there's this new data, and that part I do agree with what Dan said. There's new data that changes the model, and then we change. But we don't go out and say, well, that is just modeling, and so we can't go make policy because that's just modeling. We can't go to a green economy because we don't know for sure what a 1 degree change really means in the aggregate. You know, we have to set standards, live by, I mean, come on, we've set a standard with our constitution, and we live by that standard. I mean, a person has their constitutional rights, and when they go to prison, I mean, when they go to court, if their constitutional rights were denied, even if they've committed murder, a lot of times they can walk. And why do we do that? To maintain the integrity of what we call the laws that we design to follow. And the same, I think, has to apply to science, or else, you know, we really don't ever get anything done.
So mm-hmm. can I just jump in here and address a specific
yes.
conversation that took place on our Facebook page, which I think is the poster child for people who don't necessarily want to accept that things have changed. Okay, and this was a particular nasty one. It was somebody posted something where Rand Paul said that he did not see that there was necessarily evidence of voter suppression against African Americans, and he cited the fact that African Americans turned out by percentage in larger numbers in 2012 than whites did. So that was his assertion, right? And the people, the 200 of the 235 comments, there were probably about 200 of them basically bashing Senator Paul, basically saying he doesn't have any gray matter, he's stupid, he's an idiot, he's a moron. And then the ones who did bother putting something out there more than that, often, more often than not, were saying, oh, well, tell, you know, in 1964, they needed these things, and so, you know, it's, and they talked, they couched their whole arguments based on the mentality of 1964. I hope, I hope we've come a little bit farther, right? And all Mr. Paul was doing was, all the Senator Paul was doing was putting out a specific statistic, and nobody came with a statistic that showed otherwise. They just basically were couched in 1964, stuck there, and saying, well, we won that victory, and gosh darn it, you can't take that away from us.
I think, Dan, that is a bit I understand what Paul was saying, and he was, I mean, the absolute statement that he made was true, but believe it or not, because of the attempts of suppression was a good reason why black folks showed up more. Because,
I'm not arguing that the whether his was right or wrong. I'm specifically speaking to the topic of today's show, which is how do we have these civil
right.
conversations, and how do we advance the conversation? And people just weren't having it. They were just stuck, and they were bashing him and calling him an idiot. And the white guy has no. And this was another one that got me. If you're white, you can't talk about suppression. You can't talk about prejudice against African Americans.
That
is wholly ridiculous.
No, that makes no sense, and I agree with that. I've heard that kind of a comment a whole lot of times, and I mean, it runs into the whole type of discussions like who and who cannot use the N-word. I've gotten in trouble because I've said it's either everybody can or everybody cannot, but that is not, going back to what you said, the purpose of the show is, I agree with you there that, but sometimes I wonder, a lot of times the way we within Coffee Party, who should know better, the way we answer these questions sometimes is to join the fray as opposed to saying, you know, I mean, coming out, I don't want to say absolutist, but as an example for your thing there, I mean, I wonder if somebody came out and say, in as much as Rand Paul was disingenuous and using two data points that did intersect, that that suppression today is still evident because, and then come out with the actual laws that have just been passed in North Carolina,
exactly.
in Texas, and other places. I think if they had given the reason why that had occurred, in other words, it's not like what, you know, a lot of people do that. What they do is they give data that is mutually exclusive, but at the same time, try to connect them where there's no connection. And in fact, my contention is a lot of our misinformation is caused exactly by that. UPS came out today. I wrote about UPS doing 15,000 people, spouses not getting health care. Believe it or not, I thought, if you read what I say, I thought that was a good move by UPS, but a lot of people wouldn't see it that way because they don't understand the concept. I wasn't defending UPS at all, but what I'm saying, if you take a look at the core of as to why it was done, when you explore it a little bit deeper, you start to say, they did this bad thing, but we understand how they could take cover for this particular thing that they did.
Well, so, it really behooves us all to be a leader in the domain of channeling these to meaningful conversations. And so, you know, had I participated in this Rand Paul statement, Dan, I assure you what I would have presented was the information I knew that was contrary or led me to have a contrary belief. You know, otherwise, you're just throwing beliefs at each other, you know?
Right.
And Debbie Lynn, I interrupted you.
Well, I was actually going to say the same thing, and what I had typed here in the chat was basically what Egberto was saying, was that it may have taken a few minutes to research it, to get out of that silo of facts that a lot of talk radio lives in, where they find one or two or three points that support what it is they want, the narrative that they want to speak, and actually broaden it to be the whole picture and present the whole picture and then say, here's why there was record turnout of African Americans, which is actually representative of the population, blah, 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 or whatever that background was. But, and then pointing out the tactic of this is a narrow statement that silos information to put support a narrative, so that we're not only saying here's the whole story, but here's the tactic that was used, so that we start countermanding.
Right, a little piece of truth.
Right.
A little piece of truth does not necessarily paint the whole picture. And so it's our job when we feel like a little bit of truth, I'm sure what he said is true on this particular article, but it's our job then to sort of overcome the need to disprove something that's true and enhance the imagery with more truth, you know, kind of like paint by numbers, you know. If you just do number four, you're not going to see the same picture as if you've done numbers 1 through 10. And so I think that's a part of the key dialogue here, is that we have to instill the as close to the full image as possible if we're actually going to disagree. And that takes agreement on everybody's part to participate. Paint in their color. Paint in your color. You paint in your color. And then pretty soon we actually have a view of reality, as opposed to this little piece of truth that's standing on its own may or may not represent something you desire, an outcome you desire. And so I agree with all of that. I want to acknowledge the people who are listening today that we're a couple minutes over time. We'll probably close up in the next 5 to 10 minutes, but I think this is a good conversation worth completing, so thanks for your patience with us today. Dan, I think I heard you saying something about this.
Sorry you have me at a disadvantage.
Oh, okay. No. I just thought I sort of stepped over a couple of people. I could tell one was Debbie Lynn. The other one might have been you. I apologize.
Oh, no. I pulled back because I realized I didn't want to hijack your show. It's your show.
Well, thank you. The turnabout's fair play, you know.
Anytime.
I let her hijack my show all the time. She Janine comes and hijacks my show all the time.
Yeah, that's just a little slice of the truth. That's a little slice of truth that people might have a misinterpretation about. But, you know, one of my things that I
expect to this, oh, she's so good.
One of my little reminders to myself is Ayn Rand was not all wrong, right? I came with your name, Ayn Rand. Ayn Rand. And I am not a fan, believe me. I got over her in junior high. It took one pizza party sleepover, and I was done with her. But she still was all wrong. You know, there are other people I can point to in my life who I would love to see as villains. They're not all wrong. And if our objective is change towards something, from what it is now to something else, we're not going to get there because I, by myself, have this notion. Maybe I have an insight I need to share. I have a hard time humanizing Karl Rove. It's just me, okay? But that doesn't mean I shouldn't try. And it still doesn't mean I have to agree with anything he says or does. To me, he's kind of like the Lex Luthor of this comic book called Life. But it's still my job to hear what he says, because otherwise, even if I disagree, I cannot speak to his speaking. I speak to his wallpaper, and that does nobody any good. So any last thoughts? I'm going to give us all a chance to close out before I remind people of other Coffee Party shows or how they can contribute to Be the Media. I'm going to start with you, Egberto. Last word, closing?
Yeah, first of all, thank you for allowing me to say a few words on your show. I really, really enjoyed all the conversation that I heard from every person that spoke. So thank you very much, Janine. Great show. Great show, Devlin.
Thanks, Egberto. Dan?
One ask I would have of everybody, when you start engaging in these conversations, try to think like you're selling something. So you're trying to convince the other person to buy what you are selling. And if you've ever been in a situation where somebody has been very aggressive in trying to get you to do what they want you to do, and how, remember how much you shut down and said no, and remember that's never the way.
Brilliant. brilliant. Thanks so much for calling in, Dan. Debbie Lynn.
Well, Dan, that's just a perfect segue to getting back to remembering to ask. I mean, this is what I do. I ask myself, what is my intention? Is my intention to persuade, to be right, to, you know, sell somebody something? You know, what is it that I'm trying to do? Am I trying to get that boost of dopamine? Because, oh, God, does it feel good? Or am I really trying to forward the action on a situation? Am I trying to help the other person to come to an understanding? Am I trying to hear the other person? Because that's usually my way forward, is usually if I can hear the other person, it's a much healthier dynamic and builds the relationship much better. And I want to hear from people in the chat room and on Lunch with Loudon's Facebook page, where would they like to take this conversation next? Because I feel like this is going to be an ongoing conversation and not just a one-time show. And I'm serious about having maybe some coffee party living room conversations about this and having John Blades on in a couple of weeks to talk about that. That's it for me.
Excellent, Evelyn. Thank you so much. I guess my last words are going to be going back to where we started, which basically people can become addicted to their opinions, which is really saying that there is more power for them in their own self-fulfilling prophecy than there is in participation in the world. Not everyone who has an opinion is addicted. Not everyone to that chemistry, the neurochemistry we opened with. Not everybody who disagrees is going to find common ground. But I want to repeat what my niece said to me this morning. When a conversation is totally dysfunctional, when you feel your body activated, when you feel the need to attack or to run, or when there's just too much angst or assertion or power, you know, get thee to thy forebrain. Develop whatever technique you need to develop to put yourself back in a place where you've transcended your animal brain, where you have transcended your mammal brain, and where you come to your humanity again and can think, can reason, can hear from a position of what it takes to correlate the past and create or invent a future. And then you and I will be talking to one another. And I really look forward to it. You know that there are other opportunities to have these kind of conversations on Coffee Party Internet Radio. On Mondays, Dan Aronson, our wonderful guest today, hosts Press 1 for Democracy at 6 p.m. Pacific, 9 p.m. Eastern. Tuesdays, Eric Beiler and a host of helpers host The Middle Ground, 5 p.m. Pacific, 8 p.m. Eastern. Thursdays, here you are, Lunch with Loudon, noon Pacific, 3 p.m. Eastern. And Saturday, Egberto Willis, also a wonderful caller today, hosts Politics Done Right, 10 a.m. Pacific, 1 p.m. Eastern. My final reminder to everyone is that Coffee Party USA is a totally crowdfunded grassroots organization. Citizens United has not benefited us. If you'd like to become a member and support this effort, you can go to www.coffeepartyusa.com, find the big red member button, and be rewarded with a download of a great book. Or if you'd rather donate and become a member, you can go to that same page, www.coffeepartyusa.com, go to Free the Elected, and receive a gift of equal value to your donation from restaurant.com. So that's it for us today. Thank you for sticking around a few extra minutes. I love this conversation, and as Debbie Lynn said, we need to keep this conversation moving, both within the Coffee Party and within the world. So thanks for everything, everybody. Coffee Party on. Mm-hmm.